Welcome to The Summit, a podcast focused on bringing you the knowledge and insights for industry leaders. I'm your host, Kyle Hamer, and I'm on a mission to help you exceed your potential. As a sales guy turned marketer, I am passionate about building sustainable businesses. And if there's one thing I've learned in my 20-year career, it's that you won't find an overnight growth scheme, a shortcut to success, or a way to hack yourself to the top. Nope. Success is the byproduct of hard work, great relationships, and deep understanding done over and over. We're here to help you unlock that success with some secrets from other people, one conversation at a time. Welcome back to another episode of Summit Podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Hamer. Today, our show's guest is Van Laedemont, and I'm assuming it's French. Is that right, Van?
There's a whole story behind that. It is not French.
Oh, no. I should probably kill that accent then, yeah?
You know what? It is a French last name. My husband is from Greece, and his con artist father was trying to open a French restaurant, so changed his name to Demone from Spiliotopolis.
Oh, you're well, look, Demone's a whole lot easier to say than Spiliotopolis, right?
Yes. A lot easier to write down, too. I don't know how many letters is in Spiliotopolis.
Well, you know, when you say con artist father, like that just has to make for some fantastic holiday conversation.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Maybe we just change the whole theme of this podcast episode.
No, let's not. Let's not. Let's focus on the positive. For those of you who don't know Van is the founder of WorkSmart. She's a progressive team development and leadership training consultancy. She utilizes creativity, play, experimental learning to help involve things like mindset and skill sets and behaviors inside your workplace. Her work is built on the foundation that we're all creative. Good ideas can really come from anywhere, and everyone inside of an organization have a chance for their voice to be heard. Van has, well, is the, what do you call it? Is it an author? No, speaker at okay. TED Talks. TED Talks X, her episode or her TED Talk is called What If? The Life-Changing Power of Curiosity. I had a chance to watch that. I would highly recommend you go out and watch it. Outside of that, she's highly decorated academic, incredibly involved with local organizations like the Honors Foundation. And when she's not doing that, working with companies like LinkedIn, Pandora, Google, you'll find her hanging out with guys like me on podcasts or taking care of her family. Does that sound about right?
Well, I don't know who you're talking about, but she sounds amazing.
Sounds like the person I'm talking to.
That's great. Thank you. Yes, that sounds just about right. And I'm tired. No wonder I'm so tired. There's a lot of things I'm doing.
Yeah, no kidding. Like you might need to, you know, sit down for a minute and just, yeah.
Right.
Take 5 minutes.
Sit down for a minute.
That's awesome. No, and today's topic, thing we were going to talk about on today's show is happiness. Finding happiness in your work and how you can be fulfilled through creativity, exploration, and just being curious. Mm-hmm. But before we get too far into that topic, what I'd really like to start with is if you would share with us just a little bit about your backstory. And if I remember correct, your backstory really starts, was it 2 weeks or 2 days before you turned two?
It was about 2 or 3 weeks before I turned two. Yes.
So why don't you, for our listeners, share just a little bit of that story. You don't have to get all the way into it, but just kind of how did you get put on this path of creativity and exploration and curiosity?
Sure. So it was definitely not a straight and narrow path. So when I was 2 years old, I was born in Vietnam, and I was born right at the end of the Vietnam War. I was almost 2 years old at the end of the Vietnam War in 1975. And my dad was a colonel in the South Vietnamese Air Force. So we had to get out of there. And on the day Saigon fell to the Communist Party, he was told to get his family out of the country any way he could. So we found a way out. And our first home here was in California was Camp Pendleton Marine Base in San Diego. And then from there, we were sent to an integration center up in Sacramento called Hope Village. And it was there that my mom met Tippi Hedren, a Hollywood movie star, who was a volunteer there, who was her position there was to help these women find a career to start their new lives. So Tippi had brought in like a seamstress and a typist, because those were careers that were fairly easy to learn and easy to get into. But my mom and a group of other Vietnamese women, about 19 other women, were just curious about Tippi's long red manicured nails. So that led them down this path of saying, what if? Curiosity, right? Curiosity led them to say, what if? So with that what if, Tippi brought in her personal manicurist to teach them how to do nails. And then from there, they loved it. So Tippi said, well, what if we can actually get these women licensed as manicurists? So she went to the local beauty school and asked them if they would take on these 20 women who didn't speak English, who couldn't afford tuition, if they would take them on as students. And that school said yes. So 10 weeks later, these 20 women all got tested, did their practicum, and were licensed manicurists. And they went off into the world, and each of them started doing nails. And it was the refugees and immigrants who came after us who learned about the profession from their friends and their friends from them. And now 40 something plus years later, it's an $8.3 billion industry. And whenever I do this talk, I always start with the question, like, how many of you had your nails done by a Vietnamese manicurist? And I'm gonna say 99% of the room always raises their hands, because that's just the industry that we've kind of taken over because of the kindness of Tippi Hedren and the curiosity of these 20 women. So it's
It's quite a, as you said, it's not a straight and narrow path. So it's quite an adventurous route to get you to where you are today. Additionally, it's really, really interesting to me that the similarities between one, the butterfly effect, and just a simple gesture of kindness, what that meant for the revolution or disruption of an entire industry.
Right.
As well as you look at, 40 years ago, nobody, you ask, has anybody had their nails done by a Vietnamese manicurist? And they'd be like, maybe one in 1,000 or one in 10,000. And now it's the opposite. If it's not somebody who's Vietnamese doing that,
right?
They're like, well, where are you getting your nails done? Like, what's happening? So there's a market disruption and in that journey. Now you take that and you've turned that into your TED talk, where you really have these kind of three core defining principles. And I'd like to start there in kind of as our backstop for talking about happiness, because those three elements are really, really important. What are they?
So I talk about this within the story. My frame line for the story was this idea of following curiosity, right? And I love this concept, because I feel like we're all as human beings very curious, but we're often too busy to even acknowledge our curiosities. So really to recognize when you're curious about something, and then taking that minute to say like, what, and then the next one is like, what if, right? So taking that curiosity, like, well, what if I followed down this path of this curiosity, what could that look like? And then taking small steps to get there. Because I think often, like, even if you can get past the idea that I'm too busy, I can't even think about that curiosity, even if you can get to the point where like, oh yeah, I recognize that, I notice I have that curiosity. And then when you start thinking about possibilities, sometimes that's where we end, because like, oh, well, that's never gonna happen. Great, I'm curious about that. But that possibility, because of whatever it might be, because of the limitations that I put on my own life, that possibility isn't actually a reality for me. So I'm gonna move on. But when we add on that last step of taking a small step, you take away the overwhelm of this being an impossibility, and you change it to just one small action that you can do to get you closer to whatever that possibility might be.
Now, you use that as, kind of the three backbones and frameworks for what you talk about in your TED Talk, how things are, we talk about it in your TED Talk, and then how you run your organization, Work Smart, right? Like you've had a career that's been built on kind of this, be curious, explore it a bit. And then, with the what if, and then taking these small steps, why is that so powerful for people? Is it because that we are scared by the big unknown and the big risk, or why is that such an empowering thing for helping people find their way and their happiness?
Well, I think that's exactly it, right? As humans, we're built to be fearful of change. And I read a book by Dr. Robert Maurer called One Small Step Can Change Your Life, The Kaizen Way. And he's since become a mentor of mine. And what I loved about that book is it gave a neurological reasoning for why we act like this, right? So there's part of our brain, there's the amygdala. And way back when, that amygdala was sense fear. Like if we were, if a lion was about to attack, that amygdala is like fight or flight. It triggers fight or flight. But now we live in this environment where there's so many stressors, there's so much going on that thing's kind of going off all the time. So when we come up with like a big grand idea that's going to shift our lives, like I'm going to start a new career, I'm going to move to another country, whatever it might be, if you come up with these grand ideas, the first thing that's going to happen in your brain is that amygdala is going to wake up and be like, no, what? Like, that sounds dangerous. That doesn't sound like what we know. So I'm going to put out these neuroreceptors that say stop, right? And that stops you from making any moves at all. But the way I put it in my TEDx talk is that when we take small steps towards our big audacious goal, you're tiptoeing around that amygdala so it stays asleep so that you can actually reach your goal by taking one small step at a time rather than getting into that state of fight or flight.
And so when you're navigating through this and you're moving through this this phase of fight or flight, you know, I think it's pretty simple to go, oh yeah, that's a lion, I don't want to get eaten, stay away. Uh-huh. It might be a little bit less obvious what's happening to your body as to why we would shut things down. Talk a little bit about how you teach people to break through that or to tiptoe around that to still maintain their level of curiosity and asking what if, but doing so in a safe way so that they can find that unexpected happiness or find that unexpected satisfaction in something that they never knew that maybe they would enjoy or were even was on their path.
Sure. So my work is in bringing this whole concept of creativity into the workplace. And let me start back there because what I grew up very creative. I was always a very creative human being, but I also grew up in a refugee Asian family where you're going to be a doctor. So why do you need creativity? You're going to be an engineer. So why do you need creativity? Right. So it wasn't nurtured in my household. And so as I got older, I really just followed that path of getting a degree, getting a graduate degree, getting a job in the corporate environment. And I found myself very unhappy there. So what I did was I had the privilege of leaving that environment because my husband does have a stable job and career. So I had the privilege of leaving my job and going down this path of following my curiosity, asking what if, and taking small steps to growing the business I have now. But what I realized is that not everyone has that privilege. So I often talk about, you hear people say, just do what you love, do what you love. Not everyone has that privilege or that opportunity. So what I teach is take something you love into what you do. So that is often how I talk about this idea of if you're curious about something, you don't have to blow up your life to pursue it, right? You can think of all the possibilities, and some of the possibilities may be so audacious that it scares you. Some possibilities may be small and more attainable, but pick one. And just because you pick one doesn't mean the rest are unattainable or that the rest are invalid. It's just, let's start with one. Let's start with one possibility. And then what you can do is take one small step. Let's say you want to start a new career, right? You're not like, so do you know someone that works in that career? Have a conversation with them, read a book about it. So just that one small step. And then what will come after that small step is either another small step or nothing at all, right? And then you can move on to, oh, okay, well, what other curiosities have? I think what happens is as human beings, we think way far into the distant future and be like, okay, well, here's what I'm curious about. Here are the possibilities and how do I get from A to Z? But what we realize is that Z, if you actually take those small steps, is not going to look like what you think it looks like, right? You have zero idea what that's actually going to look like if you really do take the time to take small steps and let the next small step emerge from that.
Now we talked about in your, you know, kind of your intro that you've worked with companies like Google and LinkedIn, Pandora. I mean, you've really worked with what companies are really progressive. Mm-hmm. And so people might be, well, you know, the word you chose was privilege. Those companies are privileged enough to embrace that creativity, to allow for that exploration and the what ifs. Mm-hmm. Why is it important that companies say, no, this isn't a privilege, that this is something that we should really afford or make part of our culture? Why is that so important in the workspace and the places that you're serving?
So I think there's several reasons. Number one, creativity, because creativity is innate in all of us, if you give people the opportunity to use their creativity, then you're tapping into something that we all want to be able to do. And I say this because from experience, like even if someone, even if I go into an office and like, like creative stuff, like I'm not creative. I don't even want to be creative. But once you give them the opportunity to tap into that creativity, they're the ones I'm like, I have to say, like, you got to put down the paintbrushes now, right? You have to put down the Legos. Like, it's time to move on. So again, it's like one of those things where we're all creative. So if a company allows people the opportunity to tap into, whether it's like what I do, like visual creative tools or even creative thinking, you're empowering those people. You're empowering your people to understand like my voice matters, my ideas matter. And so again, so on a people first type of level, you are engaging your employees to realize like they matter to you. They matter to what happens to this organization. And as far as for the organization, by bringing in these creative tools, you are tapping into everyone's creativity. And if you look at the companies who are successful, small, large, whatever, you have people think creatively, you have people innovating all the time. You can't stay stagnant and grow. You can't stay stagnant and survive. So if you think in terms of just survival, that's why it's important.
Well, that goes back to the fight or flight, right? It may be your organization's way of saying, hey, this is what we need to do to survive. Mm-hmm. You picked a couple of words that I think are they're really relevant in the era, the social climate that we're in, the world as it is. I mean, we're navigating this this pandemic. The words empowerment, privilege, and there was one more. It's gone. Why do you think those words are so important to people who participate in your classes, your workshops, and in finding their own way towards happiness? Why is it that the words empowerment or privilege don't necessarily have to be derogatory or taking away from, but they're emboldening and helping? What is it about those topics that are so enriching to the people who get to participate in activities that are supported by those themes?
So I think it comes down to the fact that, you know, companies we're in a different place in the corporate environment, right? So when I graduated from, you know, grad school, when I went in for an interview, it was very clear to me, like, this company is interviewing me. So I have to be at my best. And if they want me, I hope they want me, they'll hire me. But I feel like there's a whole different generation now where it's not about that anymore. And companies know it, right? When someone comes in for an interview, it's a two-way street. Like, is this the right culture for me? Is this the right fit for me? And there's, you know, like, we can make fun of like, oh, millennials, they'd rather like they're not gonna take a job unless it's the right fit for them. But I almost think like they've empowered all of us to see work differently. And it is like, and it's a beautiful thing, because you think about how much time we spend at work, we should feel empowered there. We should feel that our voice matters. And then on the opposite side, well, not the opposite side, but what I think what corporations did and a lot of companies did was like, okay, well, great. We do want to make these people, everyone feel comfortable here. So let's get a ping pong table, or let's supply snacks, or let's go bowling together, which is all amazing and great. I think they're good shifts and changes, but empowered and privileged, I think those are words that speak more to the fact that you're empowering and privileging people. And I don't think it should be even a privilege, it should be a right to have your voice heard in the workplace. I think that's what my work does, is it's through these creative tools, you're giving people who normally don't have a voice a chance to have their voice heard. And ultimately, and you know, studies have shown it, surveys have shown it, those ping pong tables are great, those bowling outings are amazing, but people will stay if they feel like their voice is heard and they are they're respected in the workplace.
Well, I think that's, you know, I think those are great insights, and I think it speaks to your true understanding of what's happening kinetically inside of corporates, as well as, you know, the dynamics of balancing between hiring and getting the most out of a workforce. But it doesn't just happen in corporate America. Like this place of finding surprises and gotchas, following your three steps of, you know, curiosity and what if, and then small steps. This actually plays well in a lot of places. And you do some work with the Honor Foundation. tell us a little bit about that foundation, what it's about. And then let's talk about, these things in practice there.
Sure. Okay. So the Honor Foundation is an organization, a nonprofit organization that works with military special force operators, Navy SEALs, Marine Rangers, as they transition from military to civilian careers. And you can ask some of these men and women what their biggest fear is, and it's not the battlefield. It's not what they face in the military. It's that transition time, right?
Why is that such a big fear for them?
If you think about having been in the military for many of them for their whole career, there's a certain culture there, right? There's a specific culture of the military. It's a tribe. It's not just a job. It's their whole life. And to leave that, to go into the corporate world or a civilian career, there's so much unknown. It's all that unknown.
Do you think it's the fear of the lack of structure? Like, you think that they're afraid of, because I mean, you guys that are in special forces, right? They're used to taking orders. They're used to having a chain of command. There's structure and order in everything that they do. Yeah, they're very exceptional. They're high performers at what they do, right? But there's this, as they transition, you think it's the fear of, man, I look at civilian life and it looks chaotic compared to what I have.
I would have to say that's for individual. I've talked to some of these men and women who are craving that, like they want more of that. And then there's some that is the fear. Like I've lived a very tactical and structured life, and now what is going to look like? But I think it's the same for all of us, right? Any type of change is going to bring some sort of fear. But if you're so embedded in a very close culture like that and a close tribe like that for so long, I think that even more makes it harder to walk out of that.
You think it's more about the community and the culture in the tribal effect of who's around them and what they're comfortable in versus structured or unstructured.
Yeah. And just like the unknown of what that might look like. So I think that's why organizations like the Honor Foundation are such a great tool for transitioning military, because for the Honor Foundation in particular, they put them through a 3-month program called the Waypoint Program, and it's free to these military servicemen and women. And they start off with like, what's your why? Like Simon Sinek's like, what's your why? What's your story? Tell your story. And then like at the end of the 3 months, they start talking about like, okay, so here's how you write a resume. Here's how you interview. But it really is about discovering what your purpose is first before you get into these logistical and tactile things. And then what I do is I come in at the very end, right before graduation night, I do something called transition night. And it's an evening for us to get together and use my creative tool. And I can't give too much away because I don't want it to be, we try to keep it hush hush for the men and women that go through it. But we use these creative tools to talk about possibilities for their future. And it's incredible to see the possibilities they can come up with when, again, not thinking so much in terms of tactics, but in terms of just creativity and possibility.
So when people are put in this moment where they're transitioning, either they're in the middle of their tribe because it's part of their company and they're having to do this exercise, or they're going through the honor program, or they're in their own life, what are the things that they should be looking for? What are the rules, if you will, of really truly finding that happiness or finding that aha moment that creativity affords them that maybe they weren't going to be able to see before?
Okay, so I'm going to say that it's different for everyone, but what I have seen in my work is not necessarily in the result, right? It's not in the product, but it's in the process. So even putting a creative tool in front of someone so that they can think in a different way. Like there's one thing I use called force connections or visual clues. And this is something I do with the Honor Foundation, with some of the other organizations I work with. I'll just put a picture in front of them, a tree with roots or a boot, and ask them, think about what your think about what possibilities for yourself, or think about the problem you're trying to solve, and look at the picture, and what characteristics of this image represent the possibilities for you. And it's honestly incredible to see what people pull out of these images, right? And in that one exercise alone is allowing them to use the right side of their brain, which is also going to draw out ideas from them that left brain thinking alone cannot do. So even that, like that right there, people are wowed by, like, oh my gosh, like it's almost like even having that new thought is enough of a payoff, right? It doesn't have to be like, oh yes, I discovered like this is what I want to do with my life, or I came to this conclusion. It's just like, wow, like I can use that now in so many different areas of my life. Like I have the ability to come up with these ideas.
Are some of the limiting factors sometimes for people embracing creativity or being able to, you know, emphasize right brain versus left brain? Because I think there's enough out there where folks are like, yeah, I understand that if I could get creative,
yeah,
that it might be interesting. But the fear is that when you get creative, it has to be something that's going to go in the Guggenheim, or that's going to be seen at the Met, you know, as a grand opera, or this incredible production. Is there a place where people can start to get safe that it's, mm-hmm, you know, in these small steps where it's like, you don't really, it doesn't have to be a grand production. Like what is it that helps people get over that hump where I'm an accountant and I just deal with numbers, mm-hmm, that I can embrace the, well, you know, if it's colored and it's outside the lines, then maybe I'm seeing something that's different. How do you help folks get through that or embrace that other side of the brain?
So the first thing really is like trying to get people to understand what creativity is. Like, number one, understand what their definition of creativity is, and then helping them redefine that. So a lot of people think creativity is being able to sing opera or paint. And I talk about creativity, and a lot of my work is educating rather than just, you know, starting the work. So I talk about creativity as a capacity and not a skill. Right. So like, yes, opera singing is a skill. Oil painting is a skill, but the capacity behind that skill, the creativity behind that skill is a capacity. And we all have the capacity for creativity. It looks different on all of us. So, you know, so creativity looks different on all of us. So for some people, it does look like being an amazing artist, a visual artist. For some people, like an accountant, it looks like, you know, accounting is hard to understand, but I can creatively come up with language to talk to my clients so it's understandable. So the idea of putting together two things that have nothing in common and being able to combine two ideas, right? So like an accountant who can take an Excel spreadsheet, which I can't read at all, and use words and imagery and metaphors to help me understand it, that's creative. Right. So again, there's like getting people to understand that creativity looks different. And yes, although oftentimes I will bring in an art project, I always make sure people understand, like, the art project isn't about, I'm not testing your ability to do art. We use art projects at the end of a lot of our sessions as artifacts, because I know from my experience, I go to meetings, trainings, and I'll write down copious amounts of notes and then never open that notebook again. But if I have a little artifact with me that I've created with some of the thoughts or ideas from that program, from that workshop, that's something I'll always remember. I can always come back to it because it's sitting right there in my face to remind me.
So there's a couple of things there I think that are really powerful. I love the distinction between capacity and skill, because I think we as a society or as a human being, we want to be successful and we project on the skill, right? We know that, mm-hmm, with practice, you can develop a skill. I mean, was it 10,000 hours? There's a book that talks about, you know, the amount of time it takes to become a master or elite at something. And that is different than the capacity, which, you know, fuels whatever that skill is as it's manifested. So I think that's a really, really powerful distinction that can help people navigate that safe space where it's like, I maybe I've never done a jumping jack, or I've never climbed a rope, or I've never done a push-up. Well, the first time you do any of those things, it's not going to be very pretty.
Right. Right?
Like it's just not, but it's, you're learning something new. You're expanding things. So that's, yeah. I think that's really cool. The last thing that you touched on there in that, I just lost it. Cause I thought it was really, really important. So I apologize. It just slipped my mind.
Now I can't remember it either.
It's gone. Like I'm having old timers over here. What I want to ask is when you think about, so we'll cut here, but when you think about the happiness and understanding the mm-hmm. difference between capacity and skill, if I'm a manager or I'm a participant on a team where I have some influence, maybe I'm not the titled leader, but I have some influence and I have some challenges. Are there practical things that I can take without having to go through one of your courses? Are there little tips that you could say, hey, here's some anecdotal ways to maybe just do a couple of these things, going back to your curiosity, small steps, what if, but embracing that to begin creating that culture, creating that safety, that space where it's acceptable to be seen as, right, where maybe it's, you're more successful as being seen as somebody who's trying new things. You know the outcome that somebody should have, or the ways that people should be behaving to really embrace happiness through creativity. If I'm inside corporate America today and I can't take your course because you're in California, what are things I can do with my team, or things I can encourage my leaders to embrace?
So this is something that has to be top down, right? I teach this idea of bottom up, as much as we can, we want to grow things from the bottom up. But because this idea of bringing creativity in the workplace, it's not going to work unless it's from the top down. Like people from the top have to embrace it first, so that they can spread it. So I think a lot of it, first of all, is your mindset. So if you believe that everyone in your organization, on your team, has that creative capacity, and believe in that philosophy that you talked about in the very beginning, one of our foundational principles is that good ideas can come from anyone in your organization. If you can really embrace those two things, you will act differently anyway. Right? You'll ask people questions as you walk by their desk. You'll ask other people for ideas. So those type of things to begin with. So changing your mindset around, like, where do ideas come from in my organization? And the creative department, the marketing department are not the only creative people here. Like, we're all creative. So even having that mindset will change the way you act. And then when people are being creative, not to, let them fail. And let even bad, crazy ideas come to the table and come up for discussion. Because what that does is it allows someone's idea, even if someone comes up with an idea and in your head you're thinking, oh, that's never gonna work. You know what? If you get three people together in a discussion about that wild and crazy idea, that could be honed down and chiseled into something that might work. But you knock that down right away and say, that's never gonna work. Well, you're right, it's never gonna work. A great tool that people can bring into the workplace for that is from improv, called Yes And. Have you heard of that tool?
No, I've not. That tell me more.
So Yes And comes from improv. So when you're in improv, if you're an improv artist, you don't have the opportunity to get on stage, and if someone says something, you can't say like, oh, I don't want to do that, let's do another one, right? You just have to roll and say yes and then make something up. So the same thing. So this is something this is often used in brainstorming in companies, where, you ask the question, someone comes with an idea, the next person has to say yes and build on that idea. So if you do this in a group for a while, I always do it two ways. I first say, we're gonna do it, but we say, but, like, you come up with an idea, I'm gonna say, yes, but why wouldn't it work? And you can just feel the energy of the room, like, lowering. And then we switched it up. It was like, okay, now you're gonna come up with an idea, and the next person is gonna build on it by saying yes and all of a sudden, like, even when I say, like, you can see me, no one else on the podcast see me, but I'm like slumping down when I say yes, but the second I say yes and, I'm sitting up. So it's a way to have everyone's ideas matter, be supported, and in a non-judgmental environment. So after your yes and exercise, all the ideas get on the board, and now you can set criteria, right? We also call this process called divergent and convergent thinking. So I'm just giving you, I'm going all over the place, but the yes and exercise is great. The other thing, and the other principle that can be used immediately by anyone is this concept of divergent and convergent thinking. So again, you have a problem you're trying to solve, a challenge you're trying to overcome. The first thing you want to do is divergent thinking. You're going to get in a room with your team and you're going to tell them, we're going to do divergent thinking, which basically means here's the question, here's the challenge, let's get every single idea on the table. And you're going to keep doing that until every idea is on the table, even the wild and crazy ones. And no one can say, oh, that's not going to work. No one says anything. Everyone's idea gets on the table. And then you can move to convergent thinking. And in convergent thinking, now as a leader, I might say, great, all these ideas are amazing and great and valid. Thank you for those ideas. But let me give you the parameters. This has to be accomplished in 4 weeks. This is our budget. These are the people who need to be involved. So now you have parameters. So now you can go back to your divergent thinking ideas and be like, okay, well, these are the ones that will work in the parameter. And then you can work on developing those. But the concept like that everyone's idea got on that table is going to make it more likely that by the time you get to whatever the end result is, that you have more people on board.
It makes sense to me. It does. Just given the fact that you've been part of plenty of brainstorming and discussions where the first thing the person facilitating wants to do is their words. Oh, no, we can't do that. No.
Yeah.
And the thing that I think is really amazing that I think you very poignantly pulled out is how powerful language really is. You only changed one word, but the one word that you changed, you and versus but, mm-hmm. same response, and versus but, has a dramatic impact on the emotion, the response, the creativity, the empowerment of that room. And the person facilitating is the person who has the privilege of giving or taking away those feelings with just a simple word choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it goes, and that's what we talk about, that yes and exercise, as it's funny, it can get funny, and it can, it's a way to involve everyone. But really, ultimately, what you're doing is building trust.
Absolutely. Yeah. 100%. This is 2020. So it would have been 11 to 13 years ago. Mm-hmm. Melissa Meyer was the, I want to say COO or director of design. She was head up in Google. She was high up in Google. And I saw a segment where somebody had done kind of like a day in the life of one of their design sessions or day in the life of an engineer, a product engineer at Google. And in the segment, one of the things that I thought was brilliant about what Melissa had done is she would say, I understand what you're saying, and I agree with the solution that you've provided, but I disagree with your problem statement. Oh. So she kept coming back to, yeah. I agree with what you're saying, but we haven't defined the problem appropriately yet. Let's go back to what the actual problem is.
Yeah.
Which I thought was a fascinating way to think. It was like everything everybody was saying, everybody was looking at the solution. And she was saying, I don't disagree with your solution. As a matter of fact, if I started with that problem statement, I would come to the exact same conclusion as you. We need to readdress the problem statement.
Yeah.
How often do you find when you're working with groups or companies or individuals as you're talking to them, that the problem that they're really struggling with, the limiter, isn't the creativity, it isn't their ability to be willing to fail, but it's their inability to effectively define the problem they're trying to solve?
Yeah, so that does happen, again, because we are such, as you know, we are so reactive. And we want to find a solution so quickly that oftentimes the first step is coming up with the problem, and whatever seems at hand seems to be the problem. So, but what we really want to look at is like the root of that problem, right? Like kind of, I love that idea of like just kind of going back and seeing like, if someone states that there's a problem, doing work around that, like clarifying that, like, and clarifying if that is really the problem. We do an exercise. I don't do a lot of strategy work, but when we do, I often use this process of moving backwards from like a tree, right? So if you look at the dead leaves, like what's going on? Like what's the problem? Like they start the leaves, like, so what's the problem? And people think like that is the problem, but then we'll go deeper. Okay, what's in the, like, what are some of the symptoms of that problem? And we'll go like into the roots and be like, okay, here's what's happening. And then kind of dig into the roots. And then you're like, okay, so what you're seeing in the roots, that's the actual problem. You are trying to treat a symptom.
And I may be thinking of a different Kaizen, but the Kaizen that you mentioned that you were mentor before, was he the person that was part of the Kaizen events inside of the Six Sigma?
Oh, no,
Ocean,
no.
Conray. Okay. No, because they have what's called a Kaizen event where you ask the five whys, and the five whys are, you know, why do we have this problem? To your point of the leaves are brown. Okay. Well, why are the leaves brown? Well, the leaves, we should go get paint and paint them, or we should water the tree. Well, if you go through the five whys and you find out, well, the reason that the leaves are brown is because the tree's been drowned, then the last thing that you should have done was water the tree. Like it's, right. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like it's understanding what is the actual root,
right,
of the problem to get to solving it.
Yeah.
Now in your time working with folks across, you know, varied, whether they're, you know, super straight laced all the way to maybe they're a creative inside of a sales or a marketing organization, there have bound to have been some fun stories. Are there one or two aha moments where you're just like, you know, this was really special for that person and helped them have this breakthrough or find something that normal people wouldn't have seen?
You know, I've seen that at like a group level and an individual level. So I love working with the Honor Foundation. It's one of like the highlights of my career. And I love getting emails from these, again, like Navy SEALs, Marine Rangers, who like, that class was amazing. I really had some breakthroughs about what I want to do with my life. And one very specific one was in one of the programs. The first question is like, so what, build one possibility, like we work with Legos, Play-Doh, or whatever it is, build one possibility for your future. And often, and this one gentleman was like, well, I want to be the CEO of a, you know, a governmental, like I don't know, like engineering firm or something like that. But his last build was like, you know what, I've always wanted to be a travel writer. So maybe I'll explore that. So I was like, this is what creativity does. And this is what allowing yourself that time to be creativity allows you to really get to what you love rather than what you left brain thinking think you should be doing. So that was one story on an individual level. And then there was another organization I was working with where they had multiple satellite offices. Everyone was doing something different. There was no cohesion between any of the offices. So we started build ideas to solve the problem of how can we be a more cohesive worldwide company. And someone had built this little, a little metaphor for beam me up Scotty from Star Trek, right? And again, like, can you imagine if you're in a corporate office and you're like, oh, well, why don't we just beam people to another location? That clearly wouldn't go over well, but because we're building, they could build this model as, and wild and crazy ideas are welcome. That idea made it to the table, of course, because all ideas make it to the table. And then within conversation, what that idea of beaming up Scotty ended up becoming, and they ended up using it, was this concept of a work abroad program. So they developed this work abroad program where someone from the marketing team in Los Angeles would go and for a weekend shadow the marketing team in London and then come back with those ideas. So they weren't exactly beaming them to London, but that's where that concept came from, the idea of a study abroad program or a work abroad program.
That's pretty fun given, you know, A, traveling sounds like it'd be a blast right now, given that we're all, you know, a little bit limited in where we can go. But
well, traveling on an airplane sounds like beaming someone up.
You might come out with a radioactive glow. Who knows what it'll happen at this point. Oh, favorite book from the last 24 months? The best book you've read in the last 2 years?
So what did I just finish reading? I've read, you know, as you know, I have a 7-year-old, so I really haven't done that much reading in 7 years, or at least not a full book. But I would have to say my favorite book that I've recently read is from Elizabeth Gilbert, Big Magic. It's in a phenomenal book and speaks to a lot of the work that I do around creativity. And there's one idea from her book that I'd love to share to kind of end this. And it's the idea that ideas are energy, right? So ideas are floating around us all the time and they are tapping on our shoulder, asking us to bring them to life. Because an idea can only come to life through a human being. And they can tap for a moment, they might tap for years, but if you don't answer them, they'll find someone else. So, and I think ideas come to us as our curiosities. So that's why I think it's so important to pay attention to those curiosities, because an idea tapping you on the shoulder saying like, listen to me, I want you to bring me to life.
I really don't think that there's any better way to end this than with that concept of a way to bring your ideas to life and finding happiness in things that, you know, are creating something new. That's just fantastic. If somebody wants to get a hold of you, if they need to reach out, they're like, hey, this has been great. Brené Brown's like, hey, I've got to get a hold of Van. What's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
You can find me on my website at worksmartadvantage.com. And I basically live on LinkedIn. So you can also find me there under my name.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for your insights and sharing. It's been a delight to have you on the show today, Van.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kyle. I really enjoyed it. Thank you for your time as well and for having me on.
Oh, it's been fantastic. I'm your host, Kyle Hamer. You've been listening to Summit Podcast. Until next week, make sure you like, follow, or subscribe, and check out the comments and description for links to Van's information so you can get in contact with her. Again, thanks for listening. And until next week, keep growing, keep grinding, and keep finding your greatness.